I'm here today with Ambassador Ramakan, who was the Jamaican High Commissioner to the UK from 2016 until 2022. Ambassador, I believe you returned to the UK last week, to Jamaica last week, is that correct?
That is correct. And it was interesting, a very important moment, because having served for 5 years and 8 months in the United Kingdom, you know, my departure was, for me, very significant in the sense that I met Her Majesty on my arrival, and you know, it was such a wonderful opportunity to have a dialogue with her, and to know that I was departing. In other words, my tenure was kind of the rest of her lifetime, because it was just within a week of my departure that she passed, and we were very, very saddened by her passing. You know, I found her to be such a dignified human being, and one of the things that struck me is that I have known her as a queen since I was a baby, you know, and so it kind of brought you the whole sense of immortality, you know, that she's been living for so long and has maintained that composure all the way, and so for me, and I'm sure for all of Jamaica, we certainly express our condolences to the British people and to the Commonwealth on the whole, because she was Queen of the Commonwealth.
And it's a big question to start our interview with then, but what next for the Commonwealth then, given this very important moment that we find ourselves in?
Well, I believe the Commonwealth is such a unique arrangement. Being a voluntary association of states around shared values. And what this does is to distinguish it from pretty much every other, you know, organization that have brought together countries, you know, whether it's the United Nations or it's, you know, the various, you know, regional bodies. And of course, it stretches so far across the globe, and it embodies a third of the population on the globe. Well, now it is a quarter, roughly, because we are about 8 billion, and it's 2 something billion people. But, you know, has served to maintain a sense of stability, and you know, despite the issue of countries seeking to become republics, particularly the realm countries, you know, moving away gradually, the fact is that the Commonwealth remains, you know, and they remain members of the Commonwealth, and therefore the dream of the Commonwealth is something that should not go away. It really should remain, and I know the King, King Charles III, has had a very deep interest in the well-being, the the future of the Commonwealth. I've had many occasions in which to meet with him and to hear him speak about his whole dream and passion for the survival of this great body called the Commonwealth. And it also, you know, I'm also happy in the sense that the United Kingdom is no longer a part of Europe.
Well, the EU.
The EU.
It remains a part of Europe.
The EU, that's what I meant.
And of course, you arrived in the UK.
Yes, just about when Brexit was
just
on.
Before, right?
Yes,
or was it just after? I can't remember.
No, before Brexit.
It was right before Brexit.
Yes,
in a really pivotal
time
as well. So
and
really, your career is
all of that period. You know, all of that period, not knowing whether it would or wouldn't happen, and what would be the consequences of international relations with both Britain and the EU.
Mm-hmm.
All of this were sort of contemplations along the way to determine what steps should we take in the meantime in preparation for the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcome, of course, you know, where Britain is no longer part of the EU. But, you know, the trade relations we had with the EU included our trade with Britain, mm-hmm. because it was one. And now that it is out there, what sort of relationship would we have in terms of trade with Britain and so on? And it turned out pretty well,
mm-hmm.
Because I think there was good foresight, and our foreign ministry in negotiating with the British foreign ministry were able to arrive at a consensus that there would be a sort of carryover of the same plan, you know, so there wouldn't be any difference.
And weren't you involved in these conversations around Brexit and its impact on Jamaica specifically?
Certainly. Our foreign minister, of course, was foremost the person, but on her visits and her arrivals and the dialogue that we had, I had to be part of it. Mm. And
are we talking about Kamina Johnson?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes, Kamina Johnson-Smith. And, you know, we worked together, and I think that it was a great experience, because mm. it finally sort of was not disruptive in terms of, you know, neither the Jamaica-EU relations nor the Jamaica-UK relations. Mm. It went well, so we were very, very happy.
Okay, and that. I'm sorry to go back to the big issue of the Queen just dying, but I think it's a very important moment to capture as well for this project. What have been the reactions of people? I know you've been back a very short time, but has been your general impression of how Jamaicans on the ground have seen this event?
At a government level, and I would say the wider society, there is remorse. We have known this fine monarch for so long. She has actually visited Jamaica some six times.
Yeah.
And
it was the last time it was the early 2000s, I believe.
Yes. And on each occasion, it was a celebration. It was very good.
Mm.
Jamaica, however, as you know, has come through the whole era of being an enslaved. Most of the folks who came in from Africa, enslaved people, and went through very brutal times, and have, you know, a sort of sense of the history of our poor parents, what they went through, this sort of thing, and it certainly is not something to smile about. But we are civil enough to know that history has taken its course, and the question is to look to the future, and of course in the context of the lessons
mm.
that we have learned. And to this extent, there is no hostility whatever. In fact, we have very warm relations with the United Kingdom. We certainly appreciate the quality of the relationship as it stands today. We think that there is room for growth, and we would certainly like to know that it is understood that Jamaica's involvement, although we are a much smaller country and less developed, that our contribution to the well-being of the United Kingdom is, you know, really recognized and understood. Of course, a big part of that is the Windrush generation that went there, which will be probably the majority of what we will talk about. But it is for this reason that during my tenure, one of the projects that I sought to work at is to commission a book titled Jamaicans in Britain, A Legacy of Leadership. And the purpose of this was to highlight, a number of persons who have really worked and have achieved for themselves and their children, but certainly have contributed to the well-being of the United Kingdom. It's in a number of categories of endeavors, whether it's in the medical profession or it's in the field of business or it's in the field of the professions. It has really been a good sojourn for many, many of our nationals.
But on a practical level, do you think that we're heading towards a referendum at any point?
A referendum?
About the role of King Charles III. Do you think that's something?
Oh, in Britain?
Yeah. In Jamaica.
In Jamaica?
Yeah.
Oh, in other words, if we were going to become a republic.
Yeah.
Certainly. It's kind of a consensus over a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a consensus that has shared the support of both the government and the opposition, whoever has been government and whoever has been opposition.
Yeah, I know the Patterson's
over a long time. That's right.
Yeah.
I think the main question about this is whether we would go towards an executive presidency or a ceremonial presidency. That's really what the difference is. But so far as Republican status is concerned, I think it's quite safe to say there's a conclusion not only of the political parties, but also the consensus, I think, is there on the ground with the wider population.
Mm.
And I always like to remind that this is not a hostile response.
Yeah.
It is.
It's a transition.
I put it this way, it's not exactly the same, but it's no different in a sense from Britain wanting to get out of the EU in order to assert its identity and its
sovereignty
yeah. As a country. I don't see that as something that is a hostile movement or anything. It's not that Britain has no further dealings with the EU. It's that, it's asserting its sovereign itself as a sovereign nation, and I believe, of course, that that's good for the Commonwealth. Is something that it's the purpose behind it is for the good. And that's really what it is, for Jamaica seeking to become a republic, to assert its sovereignty, to complete the process of independence, which means, we have a head of state that is originates with Jamaica.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career now, because I know that you're an entrepreneur. You also were the Consul General to Toronto from 2009 until 2014, and you are and remain a pastor as well. Can I ask how your religious convictions, how that's kind of influenced your life, really?
Yeah,
and
really.
The decisions you've made.
For me, pastoral work is a work of service. It's we regard ourselves as servant leaders, leaders who are not bosses, but are servants of the people that we care for, and so it was not a departure from the whole philosophy commitment towards service when I took up my role as Consul General in the Canada, which was for upward of 5 years, a little over 5 years, and neither was it a departure from service in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
In fact, in a sense, my being a pastor has actually strengthened my ability to relate to folks, because there was that dual feeling, understanding, way of relating to people, you know, not just purely from a sort of a political or diplomatic perspective, but knowing these are human beings that are made in the image of God and have the hope of becoming part of God's family. You know, I really felt this deeply. Hence, I worked closely with the churches in the UK.
So that's, I'm quite interested in which churches did you work with? What community groups did you become involved with? And yes. how was that engagement? Because I know, for example, that as High Commissioner, for example, High Commissioners in the past, for example, have travelled from cities of London and Birmingham and other areas to engage directly with Jamaicans living in the UK, the Jamaican diaspora, and other groups. So I just wondered how the church factored into those engagements.
Actually, this Jamaica is known for its having more churches per square mile in the world on a per capita basis than any other country. At least this is some time ago, was in the Guinness Book of Record. And there was a sort of pushback that our nationals on arriving to the UK and seeking to continue in church, where they did not feel welcomed, many of them, in the churches there, because of, you know, the human, how I would call it, backwardness of racism. You know, they just did not feel they did not belong. And as a result, they started their own churches. And many of the churches within our community, they are really headed by pastors from Jamaica or who are Jamaican. And they have really been a sort of, for them, a kind of oasis, you know, in a country where they don't know a lot about. They were just trying to settle in. They wanted to continue to have their worship on Sundays or Saturdays, wherever it was. And to know that they actually formed their own churches. So there are a lot of churches that are called the New Testament Church of God, the Church of God of Prophecy, you know, the Pentecostal Church of God, that sort of thing. There are a number of them that are in that category, which reflects, you know, the majority of churches, in a sense, here in Jamaica, that people would normally go to. And it was a place in which they felt a sense, they were strengthened to endure whatever were the issues, and they were in a frame of mind of being able to grow their children in the church. You know, they have a community that they could relate to, and so on. Now, that held well for a while, and then after a while, you know, the close knit that was there began to get a little bit loose as people became more acquainted now with the society and felt they can manage without, you know, the church. So there were a number of persons who were not really attending church, but still the church is strong for the Jamaican community there. Apart from that, Britain, which was a very strong religious society, you know, in the 1600s, 1718, and coming to the 19th and so on, because you can see the landmarks are there to represent that history, where almost every township has a significant church building, you know, in Britain, which shows that this was its history. But after a while, Britain itself became a little bit more of a secular society, and so church is not as central as it was. And I think to some extent, you know, the church is now in our diaspora. You know, it's no longer, people are no longer as attached, you know, in the way they were at first. Nonetheless, church activity and church life is still strong.
Well, those, I think those connections are really fascinating, particularly now as we come to talk about the specific time period that you were in the UK. So you arrived in the UK, as we've said, in 2016, 2 years before Amelia Gentleman of The Guardian broke the Windrush scandal, and this became front page news and was a really, really big issue. And I've already interviewed Guy Hewitt, who was the High Commissioner for Barbados to the UK, and also with Kevin Isaac, who was the St. Kitts and Nevis High Commissioner to the UK. And they talked to me in depth about their work with the Caribbean Caucus and the conversations really that were happening around that time. What do you remember from that period?
Well, actually, I arrived in the United Kingdom in December 22, 2016. So I had only
the middle of winter as well.
I had only Shock. 8 days thereabout, you know, for the year to end.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a sense, it was a year after I arrived, the break in the news, you know, with Amelia Gentleman, you know, writing about these mm-hmm. things. But it was never a secret that there were heavy discontent on the ground, as the lives of many people were disrupted over many years subsequent to the arrival. At the time of the arrival of the Windrush generation, the Empire of Windrush, which sort of is symbolically the arrival of the generation, but then that was, you know, just one ship, you know, arriving. There was this high spirit of going to Britain. In fact, I was at the time when the Windrush arrived, Windrush Empire arrived, I would not have, I was born in 51.
Okay.
So
you would have been about 3 years old.
Yes, about 3 years old. And it was, I remember people, you know, when I was still young, up into the 50s, leaving to go to England. And it was real excitement.
And it, so, excuse me,
yes,
if I'm being a bit forward with this, but yeah, so it was people of your very same age who were affected by the scandal, who were
yes.
born in the same time period.
Absolutely.
As well. So what? How did that?
And they actually were very exuberant about arriving in Britain. I always look back at how these people were dressed when they arrived, and it tells you that they were very, you know, sort of in keeping with the standard of the Queen's way of dressing. You know, they actually arrived there, and they were looking forward to a good life. And in fact, a number of the persons who actually came there at that time
mm-hmm.
were there in Britain prior to, during the war.
Yes. And contributed to the war effort as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, they just went back after the war.
Well, again,
and
that's
yeah.
what we've discussed
yeah.
with this
yeah.
project, is the problem of the framing of talking about this, the Windrush ship, right? Specifically because the contributions of Caribbean people to the UK and beyond has been generations in the making, right?
Absolutely.
Far before. So
far
by
before.
Framing this as something
yes.
one arrival of one group of people
right.
actually does a disservice,
it
I
does.
Would argue,
it does.
To
it does.
to the impact and the huge importance.
And it's good to have
Caribbean
a context.
People. Yeah,
it's good to have
I
a
agree.
Context. And the fact is that for many years, they were okay. They were having a difficult time settling in, the cold, getting a job, you know, all the rest of it. That was there. But I think the fundamental error or shift that created this whole thing about the Windrush crisis was really a creation of the parliament, if you may, who changed the laws in order to, you know, have created what is called the hostile.
I mean, the hostile environment that was implemented from about 2012. But if we go back to the 1960s, there was it's been very well documented, particularly by researchers, that the UK systematically wanted to contribute to a white population, and it did that through the changing of different legislations and laws, for example, the 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act.
Yes.
At the same time that Jamaica became independent, the same year. So these things were totally strategic by the British government.
Strategic is the word. And you could see where it was going, because people became sensitive to the fact that they were not welcomed, you know, they didn't feel welcomed in the, being in Britain. And so to this extent, they already began to react.
Mm-hmm.
They began to feel a sense of alienation, you know, and this really was a major problem. So when in about 2017, 2018, Amelia broke, you know, some stories that were, it irked, you know, an already concerned and suspicious people. And so the community at large was, you know, already doing things. There are persons within the community.
So a question I have for you, yes. I'm sorry to interrupt, but as a High Commissioner, were people coming to you before then? Were you hearing of individual stories? Were people saying that either, maybe they didn't know the reasons for why they were encountering difficulties, but that they were they coming to the High Commission to seek help or support or advice?
There was the situation in which persons, they were being asked for documents to prove that they are legitimately in the United Kingdom.
Specifically by the Foreign Office.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And
what type of documents were they being asked for?
Documents of arrival. And that, you know, was such a... I thought it was so unfair.
Documents of arrival. So proof that they had landed or...
That's right. Yeah. Why? Because arrival for many of these folks was, they were children. And usually you didn't get a passport as a child. You actually arrived on your parents' passport. So to say, how do you arrive here? How do you come here? They would say, well, I came here with my parents.
Mm.
Well, where's the proof? You know, and there's nothing of that sort. And I think this is the most gruesome part of this hostility, if you may, because individuals were stopped from their jobs. They were now
denied healthcare,
being threatened with deportation.
Mm-hmm.
They no longer had access to a lot of the facilities, healthcare being one of them. They're being opening an account in a bank, you know. Various other such conveniences that you need to survive were now hindered. They were being taken away. And so the idea that, you know, the next thing is, if you did not produce your documents within a given time, you were threatened with deportation was really...
And did you know anybody who was deported? Did you hear of any stories of people being deported?
Yes, there were, speaking with you here, just at Lib, and, you know, don't have the actual names and so on. But yes, there are persons who went out of the country, maybe to visit relatives or to attend a funeral or something of the sort, and could not re-enter.
And was stopped at the airport.
Yes. And that, to me, was a form of deportation.
And so we discussed this as well. We've discussed this with other people about why that was. And it was because the airlines were now facing very hefty fines if they carried, agreed to carry people and arrive in the UK with people who didn't have the right to enter.
That's right.
So, in a way, the airlines themselves were becoming incredibly...
were drawn into it.
Yeah, were drawn into and this, which meant that people didn't leave Jamaica anymore,
right,
or leave the Caribbean, or leave wherever they... to arrive... That passage was being blocked,
yes,
and by commercial organizations,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So it might not have appeared to be government, but it certainly was government. And they... You know what it is. Dislocations of families. A mother left to attend to some other business,
mm-hmm,
and coming back and can no longer see her children, and various other things. You can't turn up to your job, so you've lost that job.
Mm.
That income is no longer coming into the family,
mm,
and the family has basic expenses to take care of. And so it's been thrown out of a rented house because they can't pay their rent. And not being able
to rent a new property because they're being asked to show a passport.
Absolutely.
Right? So then landlords are becoming part of this, yes, hostile environment.
Yes, yes.
Because they're effectively policing, yes, then, yeah, people's movements.
Yes. It was quite a way of impacting a very bitter and gruesome type of punishment to cause people to say, let me leave, let me go. And for that reason, you know, the Caucus of High Commissioners,
mm-hmm,
thought that it was time to get squarely involved.
Can I ask when the caucus was established? Was that was already long running?
The caucus is a practice that, you know, over long periods of time, even, mm-hmm, when I was in Canada, we had a caucus of the consuls.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for you to talk about common aims and
that is great. Not only that, but the Caribbean has a regional arrangement, the CARICOM.
Yeah.
And we.
So was it strictly CARICOM countries who met as part of the caucus?
Yes, the caucus is strictly CARICOM countries. There were a couple of observing countries in CARICOM, like Haiti, and so they would attend, although they are not CARICOM members.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea, so the structure was around the CARICOM, and the chairmanship of the caucus was based on the rotating chairmanship of CARICOM,
yeah,
by the heads.
Okay, so government. Whoever the head of CARICOM would be in whatever, yes, country that would
that
be the head
person.
Of, would that be just in the UK or everywhere that the caucus would meet? Would that be standard across?
That would be across. Right. Oh, yes, you remain the chair of the caucus, so we defer to the chair, you know, for that, mm-hmm, during that
so
period.
So, who was the chair at the time when you were there? Do you remember?
Oh, my goodness. Who was the chair at the time? I think at that time, it might have been Kevin
Isaac. I think possibly it was.
Yes,
it
might have been Kevin
Isaac. I don't want to confirm
Isaac. No.
Yeah. I think possibly it was Kevin Isaac.
Kevin
we
Isaac. However, there is a dean, the High Commissioner for St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Mm-hmm.
He is dean of our caucus, the longest serving member,
mm,
as a High Commissioner within that caucus. And there was a period when he was serving, you know, both as dean and as the chair.
And I know that
during that earlier period, yeah.
Yeah. So I know that Kevin Isaac told me that the caucus met with, for example, the Home Office,
yes,
to talk about some of these issues around migration and
That's
citizenship,
right,
and some of the problems. What were your memories of the response of the Home Office? Or were you at the meetings when you were present?
The Home Office, yes. The Home Office listened in, but I think we really wanted to have a meeting, you know, higher up, to bring this to the attention of the Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a request for that meeting.
So that was Theresa May at the time?
Right.
Yeah.
And it was declined. We were declined a meeting with the Prime Minister. It also was a time, closer time in 2018, when Shogam was about to be held.
Yeah, and Shogam took place in April, I think, of,
right,
of 2018.
Thereabout,
yeah.
Yes. And so because the Prime Ministers of our countries were going to be there in the United Kingdom, we thought that we should prepare the ground for that to be an issue.
So you strategically organised, and the people I know who did that, who were very active in that, was of course Kevin Isaac and Guy Hewitt and yourself. Was there anybody else who was very kind of vocal, let's just say, in bringing this to the attention of the British government?
It was really the caucus as a body, but there were persons who were considered to be sort of foremost in the activities, and Jamaica was among that group because of the fact that, well, the largest part of the Caribbean diaspora is the Jamaican community.
Yeah.
And for that reason, you know, we would have had a sort of significant role to play. I, however, was new on the block, so to speak, among the newest in the caucus. And so, to some extent, I was kind of getting a grasp of
the situation.
Yes, of the situation. Those who were on the ground ahead, Guy Hewitt, Kevin Isaac, you know, like Commissioner for Antigua and Bermuda, High Commissioner. I'm trying to think of the... What happens too is that some high commissioners were sort of not as involved because it wasn't affecting their communities as much, because, you know, it's a pretty small number of persons are within that.
Yes, I think that's part of the reason why the scandal maybe took such a long time to build, because of this. Clearly affected, overwhelmingly, the majority of people affected were of Jamaican descent.
Yes.
That goes without saying. But I think maybe it was the smaller cases as well that meant that either the issue wasn't seen as being as important. I think it's only as a collective, really, and only once the caucus started organising and discussing this as an issue that was affecting people across the Caribbean,
right?
That the power then was there. The CARICOM voices then were able to actually bring light to
absolutely.
This desperate situation.
Absolutely, it, as a collective, it made a difference, and we were able to see the problem for what it's worth.
Mm.
You know. Rather than simply in isolation.
And the Home Office knew this was happening, correct?
Yes, yes.
But they were dismissive of the examples that were coming to them, right? They were seeing...
Right, of course.
So what reaction did you get from them?
Of course, the Home Office was not particularly, you know, concerned about the issue in the first place. And in fact, the Home Office was deliberately instituting policy to get people to begin to take a flight and go back to their countries. Mm-hmm. So,
and this was part of a broader plan, right?
Yes.
The British High Commission in Jamaica since 2008 was already investing in a rehabilitation type programs.
Yes.
To create an infrastructure whereby local Jamaican NGOs and different kind of community groups would welcome Jamaicans who are being brought on deportation flights. So that's it. I think that structure was happening far beyond the UK.
Yes.
Far beyond the hostile environment policy,
right,
and far beyond the UK policy. It was actually something that was linking up to the UK kind of diplomatic actions that were taking place in situ, right? Not just in the Caribbean, but across the world, I would argue, at different points, to have this reception point for the people that it was effectively expulsing from the UK.
Right. There was an effort to create a perception that this was good for the community, and that you would even find that there are some persons within the community who thought that this was a kind of corrective action, not understanding what really these folks were going through. It also somewhat coincided with some issues of individuals who were involved in criminal activity. And that was kind of used as the reason for these deportations. It just happened that many persons who were not involved in any criminal activity were drawn in, because it's kind of a fishing net thrown out there, and you just pull in people who were not related to any of those wrongdoings.
And Sajid Javid, his response to once a scandal had kind of erupted, the response was, "Oh, but if you've had a criminal record at any point, we won't be granting you British citizenship,"
right,
which is that line of kind of criminality, right?
Yes.
Well, and also the cruelty, I think, of a system that would punish someone for a misdemeanor,
right,
or something very minor
very
that might
minor.
Have occurred 3 decades ago.
Absolutely.
So they weren't able, I don't think, at any point, the British government wasn't able just to say sorry,
right?
And just come out and actually acknowledge that the...
Absolutely. And, it is so, in a sense, un-British, much of what was happening, because Britain prides itself in human rights, promoting human rights and serving the best interest of the less fortunate. And it was quite contrary to that,
Well, it's the killing with kindness model, right? It's creating an image of tolerance and understanding.
Yes.
That when you scratch the surface and see what was actually
happening. Yes, you're
seeing
below.
It's ugly.
Yes.
It's quite shocking. So what was the role of the church then while this was going on?
The role of the church, the church...
What conversations
generally,
were you having with...
Generally, wanted to be involved without seemingly, stepping into the politics of the country, in the sense, I didn't want to be going against government when because government has so many ways of penalizing. And I think was pretty cautious. But church leaders spoke up for their community and their people, identified with the problems that they were going through.
Did they help people with the practical aspects of this?
Most definitely.
Helping people filling out forms or making copies of documents.
At a point when the issues being formalized, where there was an acknowledgement that this was wrong, and there was a commitment to right the wrongs. And therefore, individuals now had to complete documentation and so on. At this point, you know, it was more practical for the church to, you know, be involved and to help members who would fall in at risk with the government. So the church was very active, very caring, and seeking to help its members. And non-members too, you know, people in the community who were really facing very difficult times. Not only the church, but the legal community.
That's very true.
Yes. It was very, very much involved. I'm amazed at the level of support from the legal community in a sort of, you know, without any charges, you know, to the individuals, to help them through. And we have so many evidences of this in the community. So a number of persons who were able to either not to be deported or being able to get some document in place, they were able to do so because of that legal support and the support of the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so there was a network, really, of people who were really advocating for and helping people on a very community kind of base level.
Yes, I know. For example,
this very much word. Was it informal, or was it more organized? Let's just say, was it you know? Because I know that there were lots of workshops that were
at first
held
it was
or
informal,
public meetings. Or
but as we
as
got
it gained
along,
momentum.
We tried to structure, because there are organizations in the community on the ground that are in touch and who understand the problems.
Such as?
And, you have a number of organizations in terms of seeking to give support to Jamaica as diaspora organizations.
Yeah.
So what they do is to try to incorporate in their activities helping people on the ground, because they were asked, and the Home Office was being showing some sense of wanting to get the documents in. So they provided the necessary documents that were to be completed for compensation and all this sort of thing. And to that extent, the community rallied around it. But these were what you would call voluntary organizations who were charitable status, that were doing fundraiser events to support projects, whether it is in the health service in Jamaica or in
education
schools,
or
so they were doing that sort of thing.
Okay.
So that's what these organizations are about. But they actually carried over by helping people on the ground.
And what involvement did you have with the Wendy Williams report? Because I know that there was a review of that report that came out earlier this year, which was fairly damning, to be perfectly frank. Did you meet with Wendy Williams at any point?
On several times.
Were you involved in any boards or committees or discussions around the scandal?
Yeah, on a number of occasions, Wendy Williams, in seeking to get as much information as possible, you know, had convened a number of meetings with both at the group level and at the individual level, in order to pull information to get her work done. And she was very active, and also, you know, quite structured in her approach. I could see that she was seeking certainly to be as objective as possible in her work, and but the information that she required would have had to come from persons who were actually experiencing the problems, or those of us who were trying to help to alleviate the problem.
And I thought her report was very interesting because on a number of occasions she acknowledged the need to educate, basically, not just civil servants, but the broader British public, everybody really, about the impact of colonialism and Britain's role in the world, for people to actually understand why the Windrush scandal, as it happened, was just so painful. I just wondered what your thoughts were about that.
That was a very necessary thing, because the British people and in the schools, there isn't much taught about the history of slavery and the trauma that, you know, people went through. There isn't much taught about the fact that the folks who came into the country were there at the invitation of the British government, and it was for a purpose. There wasn't much that the average British citizen knew, or student in a school, about the fact that hundreds and thousands, in fact, of soldiers from the Caribbean participated in the defense of Britain in the war, and Britain was able to stave off the attacks, much of the attacks, because, in other words, we were partners with Britain, despite the fact that we were former slaves, you know. So I think that that is a sort of gap that the British people are not quite aware of. They see these strangers, these people who are looking very different, you know, to them. And they are saying, well, what are they here for? And why are they here? And do we have to have them around? You know, I don't feel the same. I feel that we are changing as a society and we are losing the real British life, you know. So it was kind of inconvenience for them. And I can understand that mindset, you know, unless you know that, boy, this... had they not been here, we could have been speaking German instead of English. You know, if that were understood, then they would say, boy, these are our friends. These are people, oh, we are so sorry of what they went through in slavery.
And of course, we began this this interview by you talking about Brexit, right?
Yes.
And of course, the loss of, I was talking recently about the loss of workers in terms of Brexit.
Yes.
So the recent conversation was, it's only when the British realise that the workers have gone that they're going to realise the
absolutely
that
it makes a big
impact. And Windrush, you know, and migration is always a story of the need for labour, right?
Right.
Or however, in whatever form that's set, either exploited or welcomed, or
right.
But it's always about the need for.
Sure.
Manpower and woman power to work in
absolutely.
Certain industries, and
absolutely.
The Windrush generation, as they're so termed, that were absolutely essential and central to
absolutely.
To that
it's been proven that unless you can have workers to continue, you know, industry and so on, then those who worked and have become pensioners, their income is dependent upon the success of, you know, the businesses and the industries that labor is required for. So unless the labor is available, the country actually suffers. But I don't think that very much is known about that relationship. And so individuals were seen as more imposters, persons as denying us of our space. You know, our rights to live in our own culture, that sort of thing. And I can appreciate that in the absence of education, because if you don't know, you could very well end up having those views. Mm. And
so back to Wendy Williams and her insistence that that is absolutely key to understanding and to moving forward, right?
Absolutely.
I would agree with that. Yes. So I had the theme of fear has come up a lot as well, because
the theme of what?
Fear of people being afraid of coming
yes,
forward.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And I think that's been very central to our discussion. So
yes.
When I spoke to Dombe Asamba, that was very clear as well, that it's not just the stories that we hear about the people that were affected by this, but it's the people that we don't hear about,
yes.
right, who are not coming forward or who are living with, we've heard multiple stories of people getting, threats from the Home Office or letters not telling their own children because of the stigma attached to the shock as well, but also the fear. So I just wondered if...
Sure, there's
there
a high level...
Because I think that church networks, for example, are very important in that kind of community
absolutely.
Space. To
high,
help
yes.
deal with those problems.
Sure, a high level of distrust existed and continues to exist.
Continues to exist, yeah.
And it is because people believe that they might be tricked into exposing themselves and be targeted. You know,
I mean, we heard an amazing
yes.
story recently about Jamaicans thinking, or people of dual nationality, for example, thinking that if they renounced their Jamaican nationality, that they could become British or be seen as being more British.
Yes.
Whereas the reality on the ground is you can't do that. It's
That's
not
right.
a simpler procedure.
That's right.
But people were being duped and being given false documents and all sorts of things, thinking
yes.
that meant that
yes.
made them somehow more British or more
right.
likely to be able to stay. So there were situations of people exploiting that situation, exploiting that fear, and
yes.
people's lack of knowledge or lack of access to support
yes.
That meant they were put in awful situations.
Absolutely. They were... They felt threatened. They felt that they were without proper recourse. They felt that the aim was for deportation, and they had to do everything they could because they had a lot to protect. They had children that they had to care for, and they could not be allowed to be taken out of the country and for their children to suffer the consequences. They felt that their jobs were really threatened if they were picked up, as someone who does not have the legitimate documents and so on. And they really felt that they were being hunted down,
mm-hmm.
And being targeted, and that laws were being changed to make them into criminals. Because before the law was instituted towards the hostile environment, it was felt that, well, I was here and I had the right of abode.
Mm-hmm.
But now when my status has changed, because the law has been, and retroactively, is now making me a criminal, then, this is really where people felt, well, we are into... not a war, but we are really caught up into a situation where we need to find ways of protecting ourselves. So people would hide, and they would not come forward, even when there were legitimate reasons for them to come forward.
And were there any occasions that maybe you yourself, particularly because of the close ties with the UK in terms of trade and investment and certain diplomatic relations, were there any times where you felt... maybe that you weren't as vocal as you could have been, or did you use that position that you had to bring up the issue of what was happening? How did you manage that diplomatically?
I have used my position, first of all, to build a level of trust and good relations with the Foreign Affairs Ministry, with the Home Office. But using that as a means of speaking truthfully to what the problem is. And I have always raised the issue that there is a problem of human rights violation that is at work. And it needs to be looked at very closely, because it is being escalated without, you know, acknowledgement. And I've spoken very frequently about the children who came to the United Kingdom, 3, 4, 5, up to 11 years old, and went to school there, and that's where they knew their lives. They didn't try to come there on their own. They came there because of their parents, and it was understood that prior to the change of the law, that they would be a part of the family and have a residence there, and to know that they have no place in the United Kingdom. They were being deported. And I've asked, you know, over and over in my dialogue for consideration to be made to change the position for deporting.
And to whom specifically? I mean, who are the people that you spoke
to? The minister, when it was he was there, before Amber Rudd, not before Amber Rudd, after Amber Rudd.
Amber Rudd, because yes, she resigned in 2019. Yes,
right, right. Subsequent, you know, ministers, you know, we've had these dialogues, you know, about how to best deal with the problem of Windrush.
And before,
and I thought that that would have been a very good move to show compassion, to show regard for the rights of the child, you know, which is a big thing globally, and to be able to assert the British model of you know, upholding the rights of.
Yeah, so as we come to the end of the interview, I wanted to ask you about the events around Chogham then. What do you remember? Were you at the table at Chogham, you know, when people, specifically Guy Hewitt and Kevin Isaac, they asked to, requested that, to meet with Theresa May, and there was, what do you remember of that time and when it really hit the front pages? And
that meeting, if I recall, took place before
Chogham,
yes, my arrival. But by this time,
arrival, I think it was in 2018. But
I'm trying.
Sometimes it's difficult to place today.
Yes. However, when Chogham was about to arrive, and the prime ministers were about to come to the UK, we had sought for a meeting with the Prime Minister of Jamaica, who was going to be here, to meet with the Prime Minister May at the time. And Prime Minister Holness actually had a one-on-one meeting with Prime Minister May concerning this Windrush matter, and was given an assurance that steps were being taken to bring this to an end. And I must say, you know, in fairness to the British government, after acknowledging, it took quite some time, but having acknowledged and giving promises to right the wrongs, then a number of significant steps were taken along the way.
Such as the compensation scheme.
The compensation scheme.
Highly
criticised. But was a very necessary step to take. And something is happening. We believe it's much too slow. But some things have happened there. The recognition, you know, of the Windrush community, with an annual Windrush Day,
mm-hmm.
you know.
The statue as well that was built recently. Did you go to the unveiling of the statue?
The statue, yes, mm-hmm. I was there. The unveiling of the statue, I think, is remarkable. It gives a sort of place and recognition to this community, the legitimacy of this community, the fact that it's a community that contributed. And not only that, but a wider community of people of various other countries are now receiving the benefits of a Windrush compensation. The Windrush is primarily, identified with the Caribbean.
Yeah, but as we've mentioned on other occasions, really the point being is
yes.
that is Windrush even the right term to be using about this, which is a global issue.
Absolutely.
It's talking to the greater, it's talking to, you know, about Britain's former empire, right? And its
exactly.
treatment globally
yes.
of those people who contribute to build that
right,
empire.
Right, right. So it is being used
point.
As a means of addressing those problems. And I know there might be differences of opinion on this in terms of why should it be that you are using this for that. But I think it is to the credit of the Caribbean, you know, to actually acknowledge that other people are being helped
mm-hmm.
because we care.
I think that's extremely important. And actually, in the Home Office figures, they include not just people from... for example, from Southeast Asia, from other parts of the world, they also include the Brexit figures as well,
right.
which I think is quite telling, really.
Yes, yes. So it gives the impression that a lot of money is being paid out.
Yeah.
But I've always asked, you know, why don't we break this down to see what is happening country by country in the Caribbean, so you can know that this large figure, you know, is not really being received by just the Caribbean
mm-hmm.
Grouping. So that is, for me, is a important...
So it's an issue that continues, right? There needs to continue to be pressure on the issue to keep it present, but also there are difficult and complex questions to be asked about things around the compensation scheme, things around people who are not coming forward as well, who may still be in a very precarious situation in the
right.
UK, as well as people who've, I would use the term expulsed rather than deported, but people who are now in Jamaica because the hostile environment has led to the point where they may have British citizenship, but they have no desire to continue to return.
Right,
so
right.
These are all complex questions.
Very complex. And to understand the pain and the dislocations that have accompanied those developments is not sufficient to come to understand, you know, because a lot of people have just taken the blow and have kept silent.
So finally, before we finish, my question is about how people here in Jamaica, what do they know about the Windrush scandal? Is it something that is discussed really, maybe in your meetings with people, or is it really something that's seen as that happened, you know, far away in the UK? And
Here in Jamaica, we do have what is called the Jamaica Diaspora Conference. It's every 2 years. And it brings together members from the diaspora in Britain to the annual conference, the biannual conference
mm-hmm.
here in Kingston. And that is one of the subject matters that we discuss at, you know, our conference, so people can know what is happening on the ground in the UK. Apart from that, the media has been pretty strong, you know, in raising these
Amelia,
issues.
You,
no, the media.
The media.
The media. Amelia, yes.
Amelia as part of the media.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Has been pretty strong in, I think, for a while it erupted, but now I think it's very much...
Yeah, it has been subsided,
mm-hmm.
and so you're not hearing a lot about it. There is also a pretty large returning resident community here in Jamaica from Britain, and they certainly are concerned and keep a an ear, you know, for what is happening there. They have a lot of still connections on the ground there, and so, goodness, with today's social media, you know, it's really, people are
connected.
Yeah, they are connected and they are aware. So I think to that extent, it has been sufficiently aware. People on the ground in Jamaica are sufficiently aware of the Windrush crisis and what. Not only that, but please remember that Jamaica has a very high remittance, you know, rate. From,
and that's hugely important, is the economic factor,
and it affects
of course,
you know,
especially the cost of living in Jamaica.
Exactly.
I've been really shocked,
so
actually,
persons on the ground are keen to know what's going on,
because
you know,
that directly affects them.
Yes, you're completely correct.
Yeah.
So all of this is part of the mix,
and again, as well as the project, that's why we're so concerned with the transnational links, because something like remittances or something like trade or policy decisions, they do have a direct impact
here.
For example, you know, if we have a reduction in the number of nurses who are in the NHS, or trained people who are contributing to the UK economy, who are being forced to leave or just don't want to be there anymore.
Right.
This is a two-way thing, isn't it? That works even more complex than that.
Absolutely. I think as we close, it's good to be aware that there's a significant number of persons, however, who were not affected, you know. I would think that it's more like 10 to 15% of the people who were really impacted by this, because others did find a way of surviving, of keeping out of the, you know, the issues that were being raised by the Home Office or by the Parliament, you know, of making people null and void in terms of their residence. They had got their papers in place. But there were so many people who, they're not as bright. They came as laborers, so to speak, and they filling out forms and, you know, having documents and all the rest of it was just not a part of it.
But as we head towards digitization, right? So the fact that now we've got, we were talking earlier about the NIDS program, for example, in Jamaica, but you know, the registration of people and the fact that documents are now carried digitally on people's person, we're creating a system, I think, whereby people can't, sometimes they can't circumnavigate those.
Right.
They can't disappear altogether from the system, right? Because it's demanding that they provide some form of evidence.
Much of the information that was being asked of these people, much of that was in the hands of the government.
Yeah.
Much of that information. And they, it was the school system, you know, they went to school, they saw the PAYE system in terms of jobs and earnings and whatever. So there was a lot of record to show that these folks have been here for a long time, been working, went to school here and all that kind of thing, the NHS and so on. So it was terribly unfair for them to be asked to find and produce documents that would not be in their possession per se, because...
Well, anybody's possession, let's be honest. I mean, who has asked for a tax document from 30 years ago?
Right.
Unreasonable demands.
Yes, except the government would have had some record. You know, he could look back at. But that, I never did see any effort to say, look, okay, what's your name? Where do you go to school? And I go do some search. Because, you know, I would have more reliable, archives or storage.
So the onus of responsibility has now been shifted to the individual to provide evidence of their own legal identity.
Right.
Right. Rather than the state actually taking a human approach, and a proactive approach by reading between the lines and actually searching for information on these people. And I think that's had a huge, huge impact.
And one thing that was never pursued sufficiently was the destruction of documents. Now, I don't have any evidence of it, but it was spoken of the records of arrivals, that much of those documents...
The landing cards, I think, I mean,
yes, the landing cards were destroyed. And I don't know. That has never really come up in a big way as part of the problem. But I think, you know, it is something that we've sort of skipped over and that probably needs to be clarified as to really where the documents, the landing documents of individuals into the country really destroyed. And it was sort of excused. It was not dealt with. So it's really one of the laments that we have.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say as we conclude the interview?
My overarching, you know, statement in terms of the Windrush event is that if we do not sufficiently implement the lessons learned document and to ensure that you know, much more care and thoughtfulness is put in by the authorities, you know, that you're likely to see this emerging in another way. So the system needs to be very clean, very clear of, you know, making sure that individuals who are in the country and have a legitimate right to be there, that it is, the records are kept very well. I believe that a lot of the problems came because of side issues, other issues.
Yeah.
And it just kind of spilled over into saying we need to get these people out of here rather than it being a legitimate issue of not having residence. And I think that too many people have suffered, and it is to be, you know, steps need to be taken. I think Britain now being outside of the EU and not having as many migrants coming in, you know, that also is a is an issue for, you know, getting workers into the country. And the means of getting these workers in can sort of recreate this problem, because you will now have to have them sort of properly registered as coming into the country, as having a right, you know, to be there to work and to live. And I don't know that that is being done, but the problem of Britain beginning a new kind of immigration for labour purposes is at the doors and at the doorsteps. And I hope it will not be a repeat of that.
Well, Ambassador, I'd just like to say thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I thought that was a really rich and really important conversation, and no doubt will be a great resource for many people. So thank you so much.
And I want to commend you and, of course, you know, the University of London for the work that it is doing, because to take an interest in this matter and to have it sort of, you know, on record in the way you are doing it here, I think is a mammoth task.
And a labour of love.
And a labour of love.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.